I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Coming up, can the U.S. handle the flood of Iraqis expected to demand refugee status here? But first, President Bush continues his Iraq War listening tour today, holding a teleconference with military leaders in Iraq, then meeting with the Iraqi vice president in the White House. Yesterday, he met with three retired generals and two academics, one of them Dr. Stephen Biddle, former professor at the U.S. Army War College and a military specialist at the Council on Foreign Relations, and he joins us now. Dr. Biddle, tell us the tone in the room. How engaged was the president? How interested in your opinions?
Well, he was very engaged. I mean, this wasn't an attempt to spin us. He wasn't speechifying. He clearly wanted to hear what we had to say. But he was, you know, he was asking questions. He was asking follow-up questions, probing people for what evidence, you know, was behind the positions they were advancing. I thought, you know, he was a good, engaged, active listener and clearly wanted to find out what we had to say.
We know the president and the vice president, who was there as well, didn't express opinions of their own. But it's interesting to note that four of the five of you in the meeting had already been critical of the Iraq Study Group's main recommendations. It doesn't seem like there was a wide range of opinions being presented there.
Well, actually, there was a fair amount of disagreement in the room. Mm-hmm. So there was a range of views expressed. And speaking for myself, I mean, what I've said in the past about the Iraq Study Group is kind of a mixed bag position. I don't think it was a disaster, nor would I accept everything they have to say. I think some of their proposals are worthwhile and make sense, others less so.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that have jumped out. What, for instance, was your opinion on a drawdown of troops in Iraq?
Well, I mean, I've argued in the past that there are two intellectually defensible positions on Iraq, it seems to me, as far as troop levels go. Send the largest force we can possibly sustain, and then you'd need to do some other things like changing their mission and so on. Or, if you think the war is simply lost and we can't succeed, which I think is a defensible position at the moment, the only logical implication of that is to get out quickly. All the kind of middle ground proposals that are so politically attractive at the moment, everybody wants to find some reasonable centrist middle ground here that involves a significant pullout, but not a total pullout. All of those centrist middle ground proposals, I think, are militarily unstable. They set up a situation where the troops that you leave in the theater are substantially less able to accomplish anything and less able to defend themselves, and yet you leave lots of targets in Iraq to be shot at.
Well, you just said something interesting. You said if you think that the war is lost. The president still seems to be talking in terms of victory in Iraq. Can you give us a sense of where the group was on whether the conversation now is about victory or about the best kind of defeat?
Well, I promised I wouldn't say anything about what was discussed in the Oval Office. Speaking only for myself and in terms of things that I've said in a variety of venues about Iraq, I think the original conception of victory, create a Jeffersonian democracy in Iraq that would catalyze democratic change elsewhere in the region, that's not possible at this point. There is still, however, a range of possible outcomes, some of which are a lot worse than others. And I think if you think the stakes are high, which I do, then I think it's worth the United States continuing to take some risk and exert considerable effort to try and get something other than the worst-case outcome. And I think some sort of political reconciliation deal in the country yielding a ceasefire is unlikely, but still possible. I think the likeliest outcome in Iraq, I regret to say, is probably failure at this point. But I don't think it's a certainty. And I think the stakes of accepting failure are great enough that it's worth the United States making one last try to try and pull the chestnuts out of the fire and come out of this with something other than the worst case.
Two polls out today show deep dissatisfaction among the American public about the war. In the Washington Post ABC News poll, 6 in 10 Americans surveyed say the war wasn't worth fighting. And in a USA Today poll, 8 in 10 say they want U.S. troops withdrawn in 2 years. How much pressure, just from your perspective, does public opinion add to the national debate that's going on right now?
Well, I think it adds a tremendous amount of either pressure or incentive, depending on what side of the debate you're on. I think it's widely believed within the national security community that you cannot long wage a war that you don't have public support for. I can say that, speaking on the merits for my own part, I think if we're going to have any chance of something other than the worst case in Iraq, it's going to require a long-term, very substantial, sustained U.S. troop presence, or at least our ability to promise that to Iraqis if they compromise and reconcile. If you're going to get something other than the worst case, it's going to require that.
Dr. Stephen Biddle, a senior fellow for defense policy at the Council on Foreign Relations in Washington, D.C., also one of five advisors in the room yesterday with President Bush as he continues his listening tour on Iraq. Dr. Biddle, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, what will happen to the hundreds of thousands of Iraqis who have fled the current war in their country to neighboring countries? What about the thousands expected to seek refugee status here in the U.S.? Will Iraqis be the new Vietnamese? We're going to take a closer look today at Iraqi refugees, and we start with Ellen Sowerberry. She's Assistant Secretary of State for Refugees and Migration. And Secretary Sowerberry, first of all, could you give us the numbers? What is the cap that the Bush administration has set on Iraqi refugees? There are caps on refugees of all sorts. And what are the numbers that are applying now?
Well, let me clarify that when the president does his annual determination of the numbers of refugees that can be resettled in the United States, that process started really many, many months ago before there was any significant outflow of refugees from Iraq. The total number in the presidential determination worldwide was 70,000. A number was established for the Middle East in general, but that number still allowed for an additional 20,000 in an unallocated group.
Well, let's check our thinking against the reports that we're seeing, because you say a number of 70,000. Just clarify for us, because we're reading that the cap on Iraqi refugees coming to the U.S. was at 500, although he could legally raise that number to 20,000.
No,
The
determination that goes to Congress puts an estimate based on the situation at a given time on how many refugees will come from various parts of the world. It's not a quota. It's not a cap. It can be changed. Those numbers can be moved around from one area of the world to another. It's that number that you're talking about is just really a planning figure, so that as we put together our program, we have some idea. But as the events in the world change, then numbers can be moved from one area of the world to another.
Do you have concerns, as others do, and we've got some people lined up who will join us in a second, do you have concerns that whatever the number is, it's not high enough for the numbers who are going to want to come to the U.S.?
Absolutely. The number of people that have left Iraq at this point that are in neighboring countries, we, under any circumstances, no matter what the number is, we would only be able to resettle a small portion. Mm-hmm. That's why so much of our effort is being placed on trying to provide assistance to those who are in the surrounding countries, and at the same time to be trying to identify the most vulnerable of those that have fled that might be unable to return to Iraq, and therefore will need to be, at some point, resettled in other countries.
Do you have concerns, as Arthur Dewey did? He was the president's assistant secretary for refugee affairs until last year. He was quoted in the Boston Globe. You know that. He was quoted in the Boston Globe as saying that he felt the administration would discourage Iraqis from coming to the U.S. because it would send the message that this was a losing cause. Do you agree?
No, I don't agree. I think our program is a humanitarian one, and it will be the decisions that are made in terms of resettling refugees, as it is in any part of the world, will be based on need.
Those that are
found to be extremely vulnerable, those that are found not to have an opportunity to return home. And let me just say that most of the Iraqis want to go home. They're not looking for third country resettlement. They're hoping that there will be stability, which is what we are spending a lot of political capital on, to help bring about the conditions in Iraq that would stem the outflows and allow for people to go home.
Of course, the concern is maybe some of them can't go home. We understand a large number of applicants now are Christian Iraqis. And first of all, what problem does that present to the U.S.? Because we are reading that there's a question in Washington as to whether to let more Christian Iraqis in, because that might add to the perception that this is a Christian versus Muslim war.
Well, the issue needs to be who are the most vulnerable. And there are certainly very vulnerable Christians. There are also very vulnerable Palestinians, for example. So as we do begin doing more widespread resettlement, it will be based not on religion, but who are the most vulnerable. And certainly among those, Christians will be, I'm sure, a large part of the resettlement, because of all groups, they probably have the least chance of going home.
Well, we want to bring in now Joseph Kassab. He's executive director of the Chaldean Federation of America. This is a humanitarian organization made up of Catholics. Mm-hmm. Joseph, you there?
Yes, I'm here.
And we understand that you have concerns about the Christian Iraqis, many of whom have family in the U.S. Because why? Give us just a little bit of history of Christian Iraqis coming to the U.S. in the past.
Well, as you know, the Christians of Iraq are the indigenous people of Iraq. Their history goes back to 4,000 years ago. And they become Christians in the early years of Christianity. And most of them, they did very well in Iraq until recently, where the Saddam regime, and of course after the liberation of Iraq, they were kind of, persecuted. They were receiving a lot of threats, a lot of violence, and therefore they had to leave Iraq. And there was a wave of migration to the States in the very early 1900 of Iraqi Christians to this country, and they settled in the metropolitan area of Detroit, Chicago, and California.
And now, Joseph, how many are you hearing from? What kind of numbers, if you can give us a ballpark number, of Christian Iraqis who want to come to the U.S. now?
Well, the numbers that we have so far, per our surveys and per our contacts with these people on the ground, I would say that anywhere between 120,000 to 130,000. And the number is on the increase. It used to be by the month, then by the day, and now it's by the hour.
Secretary Sarbre, that's a big number. Are you concerned about that?
Well, it is a big number, and we will be, as we are putting our program together, we will be looking for opportunities for family reunification, which we think is very important. But as I indicated before, our program is going to have to be based on vulnerability. So we will be trying to identify, through our work with UNHCR, which is beginning a general registration, to help us to identify those who are most vulnerable.
And we understand, we got about a minute before the break, we understand, Secretary Sarbre, if you could just briefly tell us, that there's some finger-pointing going on as to whose job it actually is to identify the refugees, the U.S. or the U.N. What is the problem there?
Well, I wouldn't want to characterize it as finger-pointing. UNHCR is the international organization through which the U.S. works to identify those refugees, those individuals who will be resettled in the United States. We've been asking UNHCR for probably the last 3 years to do more registration. However, we also recognize that this is very labor-intensive. It's a dangerous area, a security risk, and we have to do a better job of providing the resources if UNHCR is going to be able to do the resettlement referrals.
Ellen Sarbre, Assistant Secretary of State for Refugees and Migration. Thanks so much for speaking to us, and we're going to continue the conversation after the break about the Iraqi refugee crisis. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and we're back, and we're talking about the situation for Iraqi refugees fleeing that country because of the ongoing violence. A recent report says nearly 2 million Iraqis have fled to neighboring countries, Syria, Jordan, Iran. Another 500,000 have left their homes, displaced within Iraq. We've been speaking with Joseph Kassab, executive director of the Chaldean Federation of America. That's a humanitarian group made up of Catholics trying to assist Iraqi Christians. And we want to also welcome into the conversation now Sean Garcia from Refugees International, the group that produced the report with the numbers that we were talking about, looking at Iraqis and countries around the area. And Sean, tell us, what kind of pressure is the Iraqi migration to neighboring countries putting on those countries?
Sure. There are a lot of strains going on, and we're talking about very, very large numbers for countries with relatively small populations. What we're seeing is that though they are still being welcomed to varying degrees, Syria is the most welcoming country at this point in time, We are seeing that they are having limited access to education services in Syria and Jordan, which are the two largest host countries, limited access to education, health services. They are still given no legal status in either country. They are not allowed to work. And fears are growing that these governments are going to continue to restrict access to even the most basic of services for Iraqis as those numbers continue to grow and overwhelm the local populations.
Can you give us a sectarian breakdown? Who are these people?
Well, we do see really all different types of people going. While we do see large numbers of Sunnis settling in Jordan, we see large numbers of Shia settling in Syria, where they are more welcomed. We see Christians settling in both countries, and in addition to Lebanon, which has a traditionally large Christian community. But the one thing that we really do want to stress, and that we have put in our report, is that though the numbers are large, we are not seeing any one group being targeted by more extreme violence than any other group, which is to say Shia and Sunni and Christians are being targeted with the same degrees of violence.
What do you see as some of the issues that are arising because of this? We were just talking to the Assistant Secretary of Refugees, who was saying that she hoped that the UN would do more work in identifying those who really are of refugee status. But on the other hand, she understood that the U.S. had to help the UN in doing that. What do you think some of the issues are to defining who people are who might need to be taken out of those neighboring countries for their own safety and brought to the U.S.?
Mm-hmm. I think the largest question there is one of resources. The UN High Commissioner for Refugees has been severely and drastically underfunded since this war began. The resources that they have are barely enough to even provide basic help for the most needy of Iraqis. We can talk about resettlement, and I think that that's important, but I think even more important is giving Iraqis the resources that they need while they are in Syria and Jordan to sustain decent lives. Without the ability to feed their families, educate their children, and get medical services, of course they're going to want to leave to countries like the United States or to Europe because they want to go anywhere they can that will allow them to work and to live.
Joseph Kassab, again, bring you back in. Kassab, Executive Director of the Chaldean Federation of America, who you said an astonishing number, close to 100,000 Christian Iraqis mm-hmm. have appealed to you for refugee status to
Correct.
Come to the U.S. to join their families.
Mm-hmm.
What issues do you see arising? We saw a huge Vietnamese population come after the
mm-hmm.
Vietnam War. Close to a million
mm-hmm.
Vietnamese have come.
Mm-hmm.
If, in fact, not just the Christian Iraqis, but Sunni and Shia come from this war-torn area,
right.
do you have concerns about what, you know, how they'll be able to integrate together into American communities?
Well, first of all, Robin, I must disagree with Sean that Iraqi Christians, they have been a target of persecution or violence. They have been targeted, and there are many, many indications to that we gathered and we are aware of, and many organizations do agree with that.
And you're saying, by the way, just to clarify, you're saying at a higher level, perhaps, that other Iraqis, and perhaps also because they have worked with Americans in Iraq.
Well, that is another point. What I want to point out, too, is that on many, many Iraqi Christians, they helped the U.S. forces in Iraq in one way or another, and because of that, they become very target of the insurgents and the fundamentalists, saying that they are the people who are collaborating with the U.S. forces, therefore they should be considered betrayers and should be kicked out of Iraq. And I have to mention something very important about this point, and that is the clerics nowadays, most of the clerics, the fundamentalists in Iraq, they're saying that do not buy Iraqi Christian properties. They wait till they flee and you'll get it for free. So if you remember, this thing happened to the Jews in 1948 in Iraq, and it looks like they're repeating it this time again. And in the meantime, we know that they've been saying to our people, yesterday was Saturday and today is Sunday, referring to the fact that the Sabbath days of both the Jews and the Christians of Iraq.
Sean Garcia of Refugees International, do you think, given that, it's realistic to think that many of these Iraqis will be able to go home, or do you think it's a fait accompli that the U.S. is looking at a huge wave of refugees coming here?
I do think we're looking at a large number having to come here, but I do want to clarify just on the point that I had made before. I don't say that Christians are not targets of persecution, but I do not think the persecution against Christians is any higher than that against Shia or Sunni. Mm-hmm. And in terms of working with the U.S., we've also met a large number of Sunni and Shia working for the U.S. that have had to flee Iraq because of their ties to the Americans. So the situation is grave for all people leaving Iraq right now. We've met Shia who have been kidnapped and been told by their Sunni captors that it gets the Sunnis closer to heaven if they kill a Shia. That is the same degree of religious persecution, and it's extreme in all cases for Christians, Shia, and Sunni.
So it would seem, Sean Garcia, that you think that the U.S. had best prepare for this wave of refugees to come here. About a minute left.
Now, Robin, if you allow me, it is important to mention here that in 1991, after the Gulf War, the United States had allowed a large group of Iraqi Shiites, more than 12,000 of them, to immigrate into to United States from Saudi Arabia. They were mm-hmm. getting shelter in southern Saudi Arabia. And why can't they do the same thing for our people?
Joseph Kassab, Executive Director of the Chaldean Federation of America group that's trying to assist Iraqi Christians. We also spoke with Sean Garcia of Refugees International. You know, the question that's going to be raised increasingly, why can't the U.S. find refuge for Iraqis? It's going to be an interesting one as we watch it unfold. Sean and Joseph, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Nearly one in three elderly Americans who fall and break their hip die within a year. That sobering statistic is part of a series called After the Fall, published this week in the Boston Globe. Some of the elderly die from complications following hip surgery. Others become depressed because they've lost their independence and they just never recover. Alice Demner, health reporter for the Globe, wrote this really extensive series. She joins us now. And Alice, you got to know two women in particular who'd broken their hips, Angeline and Rita.
Yes, I did. They were delightful in allowing me into their lives and to watch their process of recovery.
And it was a long recovery. Tell us just a thumbnail, a sketch of each of them. What kind of health were they in when they fell?
Angeline Scardino, who likes to be called Angie, was in fairly good health. She had had some heart problems about 7 or 8 months before. But she had recovered well from that. Mm-hmm. And she was actually doing quite well when she was on her way to a doctor's appointment for just a routine checkup when she tripped and fell.
At the doctor's office.
At the doctor's office, right. Of all places.
Right. How about Rita?
Rita, on the other hand, was quite ill. And actually, her fall was probably related to that illness. She had had really major surgery on her aorta, the major blood vessel in the body.
Why do, it sounds like a crazy question. Angeline just caught her sneaker on a rug, but why do elderly people fall? I mean, what are some of the reasons why they fall?
Many of the reasons have to do with poor balance and weakness in the lower body, and additional use of medications that make them a little woozy.
Right.
Blood pressure problems.
Right. They stand up too fast.
Right. And the biggest hazard, I think, is things in the home, stumbling over, as Rita did, over the corner of a rug.
Right. Well, and why is it so devastating once they've fallen? I mean, you talk about things like depression, and how much does the emotional impact, the psychological impact of having fallen affect how bad the fall becomes?
I think that is probably the deciding factor for most people, unless they are really, really seriously ill with other things at the time they break their hip, in which case it's more the physical things that, right. that may do them in. But otherwise, it's really the fall becomes a symbol and a portent of a incredibly horrible life to come for many people, a life of frailty, a life of loneliness, of inability to get out. I think it really, this psychologically can drive home how important mobility is to us.
Well, in reading what you've written, it would seem that can be the determining factor as to whether or not somebody recovers, how they feel about whether or not they can recover.
I really think that's true, and I'm Rita almost gave up because she just couldn't face for a while the thoughts of what her life might become and how much pain she would be in for how many years.
And this depression, this fear, can trigger something that a lot of us are familiar with our elderly parents. it triggers a delirium, the sundowners, that can happen when an elderly person goes in the hospital with any kind of thing. But this sort of, it would describe it, it's sort of a wild depression and delirium and hallucination that can happen.
Right. I mean, it's called delirium, and we, you know, it's what we think of when we think of someone being delirious, but we don't think about it usually connecting with a hospital visit. But that's quite common after surgery for older people. They start hallucinating. They may get agitated or belligerent, which is totally unlike their personality, or they may become so sleepy and groggy that they really have no sense of where they are or what's going on.
So all of these factors combine and make it so tough for them to recover. What can families and caregivers do to fight this? Because the way you write it, it's a battle, you know, as to whether or not the depression's going to win or the family's going to win.
Right. Yes, it is, definitely. I mean, I think the families really have to provide as much strong support and encouragement as they can. That's critically important. And also to get the medical care. I mean, a lot of times, you know, delirium is something that can be treated often by changing medications or withdrawing medications because medications are a big source of delirium. For depression, again, we know we have good treatments for depression. They don't work for everybody, but they can help a lot. And just addressing often also the fear of falling, which is another area that is, you know, in Angie's case, that was her main issue. Was she was afraid to do too much because of fear that she would fall again and suffer even worse consequences.
And the thinking now is, I mean, it used to be that elderly people were put in traction and, you know, they had to lay in bed for months. And now the thinking is to do the surgery and get them moving.
Exactly. I mean, the idea is, and the standard of care is now to try to operate within 24 to 48 hours and have the people up and out of bed the next day and walking.
So how important, then, is that recovery time, given, as we said, that so many people die within the year? And how big a factor is that fear that they're going to fall again?
The fear is a huge, huge factor. And there's not enough research on how to address it at the moment, and most people in the field would agree with that. But that can become just the stumbling block. I think
literally,
yeah. Exactly. And what right now the best way to deal with it is to try to coax people through the activity that they're feared, you know, that they're afraid of doing, with help, with support from a family, with physical therapy, et cetera. But, you know, maybe in the future we figure out that it's really better to have some sort of counseling or cognitive therapy or something that to help people deal with a fear that's not totally irrational, because once you fall, you are at greater risk of falling again. And a large number of people who do break one hip fall and break the other.
I just want to ask as a reporter, because you spent, well, it seems like over a year following this?
Yes, people? I did. I spent over a year following these lovely women.
And sometimes you'd be the only one at home with them as they spent hours deliberating whether to take five steps. How hard was that for you not to just rush in and help them, you know, hold their arm? Because, you know, the fact is they had to see if they could do it by themselves, if they could live in one case by themselves or walk to the mailbox. How hard was that for you not to?
It was hard, because you do, you know, and when you spend that much time with someone and with people particularly who are so welcoming and open to, you know, allow a reporter in their lives for this length of time, you want to be helpful. You want to see them recover. Mm. But on the other hand, I wanted the story to be true to life and not to be, you know, inserting some help that they would not have otherwise.
Your article gives some tips for families. I mean, the obvious things: clear the house out, make sure there's no clutter around an elderly person. Wall-to-wall carpet is better than, you know, shag rugs. But what are some of the other things that people can do to prevent falls? I mean, for instance, wear shoes, not slippers. What are some of the other things?
One of the important things is to exercise as much as they can to strengthen their lower bodies. A lot of people like to get out and walk. That's great. That's a great way to do it. Take Tai Chi for balance or other practice balance in other ways. Make sure your eyesight is good or you have corrective lenses. People stumble, you know, because they can't see. Watch what medications you're taking. Be careful about sedatives, sleeping pills, and get treatment for osteoporosis. If you fall and your bones are brittle, they're much more likely to break. It's kind of obvious, but unfortunately, a lot of people aren't getting treatment.
And just to highlight once more what to do to boost the odds of recovery, get out of bed.
And lean on your friends. Get your friends to help you, your family to support you and encourage you along.
Alice Demner, health reporter for the Boston Globe, for her extensive series on what happens to the elderly when they fall. You can go to our website, here-now.org. Alice, thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And you are listening to Here and Now. Well, now we're joined by Angie Scardino, one of the women profiled in the Boston Globe series. She's living with her daughter, recovering from hip surgery that she had roughly a year ago. Angie, how are you feeling?
Well, I take one day at a time. There are days like when it's stormy out and such, that brings out all the aches and pains.
And does it bring out the fear as well? Because we understand that's a huge factor. What's that feeling like to be afraid that you might fall again?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There's that fear. But I tell you, I use my walker. Now, there's a railing. That's very important, a railing on both sides of the stairs.
Right.
So that I take the walker and I go just so far outside the door with the walker. I leave it on the landing. I take and hang on the banister, take one step at a time. Get down to, it's just three steps, but it seems like 300.
Mm, yes. You are 82 years old, but this was all new to you. I mean, this idea of this terrible fear of falling. How did you get past that point? Because in reading your story, there was a point where you seemed stunned to realize that, you know, just to walk a couple of steps was difficult. What helped you decide to push ahead and make yourself take those few steps as opposed to just, you know, curling up in a ball?
I had just come to the conclusion that my daughter is, I'm living with my daughter now, recuperating. She is simply great.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, I cannot impose on her too much. She has to work, and I've got to go back and learn how to do things for myself.
Of course, we should say your daughter, Joanne, was, you know, terribly frightened for you. It didn't want you to do too much on your own, so you had some conflict there. But,
no.
but you know, the idea that, you know, in other words, it was the idea that you really needed to do this for other people that helped you push yourself forward.
Yes, what made me do it, I forget her name, but I was in the rehab. And when I first got up and started to walk, the lady in the room there, I guess she had some surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And she looked and she says, you are my inspiration. I looked at her. I says, I can't do anything. She says, oh, yes, just seeing you get out of bed and walk, even a little ways in the room, she says, makes me feel like I want to get up and walk, too.
It does seem as if the people who just quit in their mind,
yes,
that they are going to be in trouble.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
You need the support of the family. And, you know, another thing I think is, which means a lot, people might poo-poo at this, but I think a pet. Like I have a little, two dachshunds.
We've heard that you know, having, you know, someone furry like that to give some love to is part of hanging in.
Yes.
Yeah.
You need, believe me, patients that are beyond what you ever anticipated. I probably am impatient with Joanne, but she is patient with me and tells me, Mom, just be patient.
What's the one thing that you would want people to know to avoid, first of all, falling, and then how to get back up again? You know, I don't mean from the fall, but from the big, you know, the surgery and everything. So I guess two things. What are the two things you'd want people to know? How to avoid it, and then how to survive it?
Well, how to avoid it is don't take chances. Make sure every step you take at our age, we have to make sure that we have that counterbalance and that willingness to go on. The pain is there, believe me. Get yourself interested in something. You can't depend on the family to do everything and do this and that and the other. You've got to try and do it yourself.
Angie Scardino is 82 years old, recovering from a hip surgery after a fall, living in Franklin, Massachusetts. Angie, we just wish you the best.
Thank you very much. And I hope this helps someone else.
It will. Well, just a quick last thought. If you do get a pet, as Angie has one, make sure you don't trip over your pet. Stay with us. More ahead, Here and Now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Not so long ago, forensic science was for, well, forensic scientists, or maybe fans of the old TV series Quincy. But that changed 6 years ago with the debut of CSI, Crime Scene Investigation, which made corpses and fingerprints water cooler conversation, and also made its star famous. William Peterson plays Gil Grissom, the head of a Las Vegas crime scene investigation unit, bent on finding the truth.
Forget about the husband, Warwick. Forget about the assumptions. Forget about your promotion. These things will only confuse you. Concentrate on what cannot lie. The evidence.
Peterson set Hollywood abuzz when he announced he'd take a hiatus from CSI in the middle of the season in order to appear in the play Dublin Carol with the Trinity Repertory Company in Providence, Rhode Island. His character, John Plunkett, also deals with dead bodies. He's an undertaker. But this alcoholic Irishman facing his past on Christmas Eve is a far cry from CSI's cerebral Grissom. Here Now's Emiko Tamagawa caught up with William Peterson at Trinity Rep to ask, why the stage instead of the TV screen?
I grew up in the theater. You know, I mean, the TV thing came very late in my career. And I haven't been able to do a play since the show started, which was in 2000, I think. So I just wanted to be able to get back to the stage. And Kurt Columbus, who's the artistic director here at Trinity Rep, sent me the play last spring, and I read it, and I loved it. So I went to CBS and said, is there a way that I can do this over Christmas next year?
And what is it about live theater that really has its hold on you?
There's just a great thrill to it, especially if you have a great piece of material. First of all, to be able to tell a story straight through from beginning to end. We never get to do that in movies or television. You know, it's all chopped up, and we do a scene from here and then a scene from the end in the beginning. And, you know, you never get a chance to really feel like you're telling the story. And it's still, to my mind, the best format for storytelling in the world is the living theater.
I'm thinking the other thing that must be an attraction is the character that you play on CSI is very intellectual, very self-contained. This is not how I would describe John Plunkett.
Well, he's he's some kind of unfortunate everyman. You know, obviously he's an alcoholic who's been struggling his whole life with the bottle. And his boss, who's been sort of taking care of him for a number of years and keeping him somewhat of the straight and narrow, is in the hospital sick, and he's kind of at wit's end. He's kind of lost without him, and he is visited by his estranged daughter. And he's a fascinating character because he, you know, despite all of the tragedy in his life and all of the mistakes and all of the sort of trauma that he's inflicted on himself as well as others, he continues to fight the good fight. He continues to hope that he somehow or another will make it. And I think that's the great message of the play, is the hope at Christmas that we, you know, there's a lot of difficult times for people at Christmas. And I think this show points that out and addresses it in a beautiful way.
Are you a Christmas man?
Yeah, I suppose I am. I like Christmas.
Get the little lady a present and so on.
Well, I suppose you have to, don't you? You know?
You have to. Get her a nice jumper or something.
Get her a nice dinner.
Oh, she'll be delighted. Nice pair of socks in the pockets. Little surprise, though.
There's a scene with the other undertakers, as a sort of a new guy. Yeah. The other guy keeps trying to leave, and your character keeps finding ways of making him stay.
Yeah, he's terrified of being alone, I think, and what'll happen to him in terms of the drink, you know, and his demons and his, you know, he somehow or another, as long as he can stay involved with someone and talk to them, he can somewhat survive. And so he sort of ensnares this young nephew of his boss to listen to his stories.
When I go, though, very small.
Yeah?
Keeping it all very quiet.
Yeah?
Spare people the old hassle.
And for what favor one pay the respect to you?
Respect is no use to you when you're gone. If you haven't earned it while you're alive, don't be looking for it just because you happen to die. I never really did any great things. In fact, I've done many things which, to tell you the truth, I'm very, very ashamed of. And if you've let people down, don't be wanting to be all crowding around talking about what a brilliant fella you were at your funeral, you know?
You mentioned his estranged daughter. Can you talk a little bit about their relationship?
Yeah, that's a very difficult part in the play, the middle of the play, where his daughter comes to tell him that her mother's dying and that she hasn't seen him in 10 years because of his struggles and his weaknesses. He has certainly not been a father in any sense of the word. And she comes to see if he will do this one thing for her in terms of her mother.
Well, I should, I think I should.
Of course you should. What are you talking about?
I'm just saying I have to go in.
Of course you have to.
What's wrong?
It's just you make it like such a chore for you.
No, it's just, I've been in and out seeing Noel, the man who runs this business. It's just going to the hospital. I don't know. I didn't mean anything.
Come with me today.
He fights with it because he doesn't feel not only qualified, but that he even has the right to be around them anymore. The great thing about John Plunkett in this play is that he is not afraid of his failures. He's not afraid to hide them. He is hidden in his life from all kinds of conflicts and all kinds of responsibilities. But he knows that. He knows that he's done it, and he doesn't know exactly why, but his self-loathing is pretty full, but his self-honesty is pretty brave.
I know you want me to say I'm sorry.
No.
But I can hardly remember anything. I was in a very bad state. I don't want to make any excuses, but Jesus Christ, I was in hell. I was in agony, and nobody knew. And I didn't know what to do about it. You don't know. I am sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry about the whole stinking business.
I have to ask you just one quick CSI question, just because to me, I mean, you have CSI, you have CSI New York, CSI Miami, and countless numbers of other shows do some sort of ripoff of the genre. What do you think is the appeal of it?
Well, when we first created the show, I felt that it was a perfect time for a show like this because of, the O.J. trial. There was a whole lot of the country not understanding what forensic science had to do with crime and criminals. And when the idea for this came out, we just thought, God, this could be great. I thought there would be a niche audience for it. I didn't know that it was going to be a huge worldwide audience. Nobody did. I went to a pathologist convention a few years ago down in New Orleans. They gave me an award for sort of raising their profile, and it was fascinating because they all said, for the longest time, people would ask us what we do, and we'd say we were coroners or pathologists, and they would turn away and walk away. They didn't want to talk to them. And now they were getting, people were fascinated by them all of a sudden at cocktail parties and whatnot. So there was a place for a show like this, if we could do it right.
As you said, you are a stage actor. You were a stage actor for years, in addition to doing films and television. Now that you've had this taste again, is it tempting to just sort of give it all up and go back to the stage again?
Well, I've been blessed. Obviously, in my career, to be able to do all of these things. I've managed to be able to be a big part of three completely different mediums, and they're three very different muscles for an actor. I would never say no to any of them. I would like to get more theater back into my life, certainly, and I will. If I were to have my druthers, I would be in the theater first and foremost and do movies and television as I could. And I have been fortunate to be able to do that in my life, in my career. So, I can never say really anything bad because it's been a blessing.
Actor William Peterson. For more about Dublin Carol and the Trinity Repertory Company, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.